You're listening to The Point Is on KZFR. I'm Stephen Schutte, sitting in for Sue Hildebrand. Our topic this morning is the aims of education, and we want to explore what can be and is being done in and outside of schools to raise up a kinder, gentler, and more secure generation. With me on the phone now is Beth Swadener. She teaches at Arizona State University in the School of Social Transformation. She's a professor of culture, society, and education, and also a professor of justice and social inquiry. And those titles give you a general indication of her interests. More specifically, she's a specialist in early childhood education and has traveled all over the globe collecting children's and family stories. Welcome, Beth Swadener.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you're focusing on this topic. Care a lot about it.
Great. Let's start a little bit with your work at ASU. You're obviously interested in, you're removed from the typical academic interest. Your scholarship is scholarship in action. What do you teach and what are you trying to accomplish with your students?
Okay. For most of my career, I have been a professor in education, early childhood special education and educational policy studies, and with some reorganizations, happily found myself in a program that brings together ethnic studies of several sorts, women and gender studies in our new area in society, culture, and education. And I do a lot of work on children's rights and voices and trying to understand what we can learn from other nations that have actually signed on to the convention, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, mm-hmm. and how they're enacting policies. So I teach courses on things like education policy, children's rights, critical advocacy, sociocultural aspects of education, those sorts of things in recent years.
I'm curious, are these undergraduate courses primarily or graduate?
Primarily graduate, although mm-hmm. my course in the coming semester will be an undergraduate course focused on children's rights in international context. And students are coming from some really interesting majors. There's a certificate you can do at our university on human rights, and a couple of them are in that. There's some people who are studying sort of child or youth studies, and then there are others that are in justice studies.
Those are excellent. I'm an old teacher educator myself, but
yeah.
We didn't have those kinds of courses back when I was doing that kind of work. Let's go on to particularly your international work. I was interested in a couple representative titles of your work. You were talking about challenges to inclusive education in Kenya. You've talked about inclusive education, examining equity on five continents. That's the title of a book that you contribute an essay to. Please tell us a little bit about that work, how long you've been doing it, and where you have gone.
Okay. That work is in collaboration with a colleague from Kenya, a former doctoral student from many years ago, Kagenda Mutua. And most of my international work for over 25 years has been in sub-Saharan Africa, initially in Senegal and the Gambia, looking at policies for early childhood education, preschool, et cetera. And then I had the opportunity to come to Kenya, where I've been doing work since 1992. And part of that has been work that we drew upon for that chapter, where we collected narratives or basically interviewed families, children and families, about how things were changing in their lives as it pertained to the care of the youngest children, their access to and opportunities for education, how they viewed that education. And then Kagendo has focused a lot on children with special needs. She's more in the special education field. And so we were looking at a range of issues, including even how everyday things like language can culturally shape how a society views persons who have various differences, such as special education needs. And in that case, we were looking at nouns in everyday usage in the language of Swahili or Kiswahili. It got very precise at points, but how there are different classes of nouns. And the noun that's used for the word to describe persons with disabilities is in a class with non-living things. Whereas other nouns are in a class of nouns that is applied to people, plants, and animals. So, I mean, just you never know where an inquiry will take you. But that is one that I've been working on, another piece from this morning, in fact. But I guess if you wanted to put an umbrella over my work across my career, because I'm pretty far into my career by now, is that I have tried to connect global issues and struggles and policies with local experiences. So how are families struggling under neoliberal policies that have meant that some of the things that used to be provided for free are now at quite a cost, or cutting back of jobs and wages through austerity measures like we've seen in Europe. And, in fact, I've also done quite a bit of work in Greece since 97. I go fairly regularly there and have lived there as well, and done work with colleagues in a place called Thessaloniki. It's in the north.
Mm-hmm.
And our collaborations have taken us into communities primarily of Roma and immigrant populations.
How do you select families and individuals for interviews?
Local nomination and volunteers, and any research I do in another country is always collaborative,
mm-hmm.
By definition, with someone locally in the lead. And I come and collaborate with them. It's kind of my style of working. And so they often already have contacts and certainly would have the local languages required if we can't do interviews in English.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of your observations? I know it's too long to go into on the air, but what is are kids getting more access to education? I'm thinking particularly young women. What do you see happening?
Yes. I work closely with a non-governmental organization called the Girl Child Network in East Africa, and they have been very instrumental. They're an umbrella group of over 200. Community-based groups, et cetera. And they've been so instrumental in getting legislation passed. And, of course, that's only the first step. You have to make sure it is enacted and make sure it happens on the ground. But everything from, not to embarrass readers or listeners, but everything from making what they would call sanitary towels or provision for girls not to miss school when they're having their periods,
mm-hmm.
To more sanitary conditions, to educating boys and girls about different things that were interfering with education at a very basic level, to making sure that there's legislation that one can turn to and say, this child has a right to this education. Families should not have to decide which child they'll invest in, which still goes on so much
mm-hmm.
In African contexts and other parts of the global south. You know, they'll decide, well, where am I going to get the greatest return? Probably that boy, that older boy, that firstborn, and many of us have been advocating for quite a long time that it should be appropriate education, not just a heavily post-colonial or, you know, Western education always,
yes. mm-hmm.
but that it there should be access for all, or education for all. And there have been some real strides in that. In fact, some countries, the balance has tipped. Of course, women are a slight global majority at 51% in most societies. And in many countries now, over half of the children going to school, even through what we would call middle school and secondary, are girls. So there's some very positive indicators on that front, Stephen.
And how is the curriculum itself changing? I mean, the Brits loom large in Africa, as a friend of mine once said. That's the sort of thing the Brits like to leave behind, these long traditions of British-style education, a focus on a knowledge curriculum and a very British or Western kind of curriculum. What do you see happening to change that?
Well, I see a mix of things. When I've lived in Kenya, I actually worked at it's called the Kenya Institute for Education, and they develop all the curriculum. Like most countries on the planet, they have a nationalized curriculum. And yes, it has a lot of British carryover. Since independence in 63, that persists. But they also have tried to do some interesting things around sustainability, environmental education, and culturally relevant education.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early childhood sector, I was very pleased. The funds have been cut for this, but back in the 90s, it sounds like a long time ago. For me, it wasn't so long ago. Mm-hmm. But by the mid-90s, they had something called the Mother Tongue Storybook Project, where they were encouraging communities to keep languages alive, very much like we would be concerned
yes.
about in the United States with indigenous language loss. So they have had some initiatives in mother tongue maintenance or first language maintenance. But a lot of those things are kind of a wash when you look at the meritocracy or the high-stakes testing, which actually would be very similar to No Child Left Behind and that yeah. legacy. Mm-hmm. So they still put a lot of stock in tests, competitive tests. You go into any school and you see a list of children by their grades. And I'm very involved at any point in time in the education of 20 Kenyan children, and that changes as they graduate, and that's through a nonprofit or NGO that I co-founded called the Jirani Project. And the kids named it. It means neighbors. And this is enabling, like, AIDS orphans and kids who I first met maybe living and working on the street or street kids to finish their education, get some post-secondary, and then we launch them into a career. And I see more and more programs like that cropping up, and I'm encouraged by that.
Do you have a website for the Jirani Foundation or other ways in which listeners can learn more?
I sure do. We sure do. It's J-I-R-A-N-I, Jirani Project, all one phrase, .org, JiraniProject.org.
Okay, I will also post that on our website so people can link to it directly.
That's great. We're about to have a camp. Some about 12 youth volunteers from the state of Wisconsin have gone the last 4 years, and they'll do a week-long camp so kids from the slums in Nairobi can have sort of a fresh air experience, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they're about to have elections, national elections in March. And so they'll be, this may strike you as funny, but they're going to be writing some haiku poetry about the potential of more peaceful elections.
Great.
The last
mm-hmm.
elections were quite violent.
Yes, okay. I'm also an old English teacher as well as being a teacher educator. So, I love the sound of that, that you can get kids to express themselves in imaginative ways, not just the formal essay.
Right, right. And, of course, they're real into rap, and mm-hmm. I'm sure some of them have heard about tweeting and the like, but we're going to go with haiku this time at camp.
Right.
There's no electricity there to speak of.
Okay. Beth Swadner, one of your articles addresses living in ethical and caring ways. I wanted to ask first, how do you see that as a school versus or and or a family issue? Can schools, in fact, presume to teach ethics or ethical attitudes?
Well, I think they can and they should. And I know that applied ethics is relative and needs to take into account many different cultures and worldviews, of course. But I think it's a both and, not an either or,
mm-hmm.
That the school and the families that it serves and certainly the children and their perspectives should be respected. I've done a couple of ethnographies, or really in-depth studies of schools. One was a friend school, a Quaker school, sometime back in Pennsylvania, and there they were using strategies such as consensus decision making and learning through conflict, not just trying to avoid it, but really mm-hmm. learning through it. I have some concerns about some aspects of the packaged programs or curricula, like the character counts. That I might or might not get into the details of, but it's a step. But I think that certain things need to be modeled, and it's actually been a lot harder for teachers and buildings and school communities, if you will, to focus on some of these ethics of care, anti-bias curriculum, anti-bullying curriculum. It's actually been harder for them to focus on it with so many tests to take care of, with so many sort of neoliberal policy pressures on schools, a narrowing of the curriculum to just focus on certain things that can be tested, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I've really got to see, I was seeing a lot more of that earlier in my career than I've seen it in the last decade, I'll put it that way.
Yes, and that pretty much corresponds to the absolute rise of standardized testing, though it's been around for 40 or 50 years at least, but now really right. dominates the scene.
It does. It does. And when your children's test scores, and that does segue back to Africa a little bit, you know, when scores are posted and schools are graded, and believe me, I've done a lot of work. I've spent 12 years in Northeast Ohio and worked extensively in the Cleveland mm-hmm. public schools and other urban settings there. And I'm a bit of a specialist in urban education, but I've just seen any, you know, hope of trying to do some more equitable things in the face of the savage distribution of resources
mm-hmm.
Combined with the zero tolerance that, you know, children are are kicked out and then have a really hard time getting back in many cases. And I think, again, you know, there need to be more in-school strategies. There need to be more of the kind of ethic of care we were just talking about available to children. And they really need to be an extension of the community and draw from the community's funds of knowledge, which is a concept that colleagues at University of Arizona have been talking about for the last 20 years, and I think it's a good one.
Yes.
Every community has its own funds of knowledge, and those are not on any bubble exam forms. You know,
right.
They're not something that can be tested.
Right. Do you find the charter schools have any greater freedom to do critical pedagogy?
I think in some cases they do. I also see them in a larger picture, often as part of the problem. However, uh-huh. I would so much rather that we make our public schools work, because I'm one of those old fashioned people, I guess, that
right.
thinks they're our last best hope for democracy, mm-hmm. is that kids will have more or less equal access. And when you look at who is able to find the transportation or win the lottery, popular media like Waiting for Superman depicts, you know, not everyone has access to alternatives. And
right.
I'd rather the alternatives be far more accessible to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I understand. Here's a much too broad question as we move toward our close, but here it goes anyway. What are your best hopes and wishes for meaningful reform in education? And I'm thinking both around the world and here at home, where we desperately need that kind of reform.
Right. I think we need to build stronger alliances, and I think we need to listen to children. I think children can actually teach us so much, and as someone who studies children's rights and voices internationally, I've seen projects that truly do, as the Convention on the Rights of the Child states it, give children's views due weight, give them serious consideration. And I think as we look at what we should be doing in education, we should actually be talking to the consumers of education a lot more than we do,
mm-hmm.
and not in some cute, tokenistic way, but in a very deep and sincere way that does give their views due weight. So I think we should include children more and listen to what they're telling us. I think we should also, as I said earlier, form these kinds of alliances across different groups and have more forums for communities to come together. I think there have been waves of school reform, such as in Chicago. I'm not talking about recently necessarily with the strike and what Mayor Emanuel did in response to it. I'm talking more about local school councils and more community involvement and community liaisons and, of course, you know, keeping schools safe.
I mean,
we should definitely be protecting our children and not our guns. That would, mm-hmm. would be very important. And our head of education in this state and now our attorney general has just suggested that there be one principal and or teacher in every school in Arizona who is trained to use a gun and carry one at all times. And I think that's taking us in absolutely the wrong direction.
Yes, yes.
If we want to promote an ethic of care and model responsibility around young children.
As a matter of fact, our local weekly newspaper here, the Chico News and Review, has some excellent letters to the editor this week echoing that point.
Good.
Foolish to arm teachers, just asking for all kinds of trouble and not getting to the root of the problem. What are you going to work on next in 2013 and beyond?
Okay. Well, we have a big event coming up. It's annual, but I work on it a lot this time of year. In fact, Sue Hildebrand was very much part of that when she was in Arizona. And it's called the Local to Global Justice Teach-In. Old-style teach-in. We have someone coming from Kenya, in fact, as one of our keynoters. The theme this year is justice for women, justice for all, in a very inclusive sense. And we have a youth teach-in for the sixth year as part mm-hmm. of that. And about 300, 400 activists from all over the Southwest gather at the ASU campus the last weekend of February and just look at how we can understand each other's issues and get more done on the activism front. And I'm working on two books, one on children's rights and education. That wouldn't come as a surprise. Another one that's looking at global imaginaries of what is possible for young children. So very much related to what we've been talking about, and contributors in these edited books from 11 different countries. So I really like to be part of these global dialogues, if you will, learning from each other about what we can do to better serve our children and our communities.
Excellent. Is there a website for the teach-in in February?
Yes, there is. It's just simply local2global, local2global.org. And we're still accepting proposals, and we would love to have some California folks come. We offer homestays, free, primarily vegan food for 3 days. We're going to be showing a film called Open Heart that is an Academy Award finalist on Friday night, February 2nd, to kick off our three-day event. So local2global.org. I would just love to see some folks from Chico and Northern California come out.
Very good. We'll not only post that, but talk it up with the educators that we know.
Fantastic. Thank you.
We want to thank you for being with us this morning. We've been talking with Beth Swadner of Arizona State University, doing amazing work in global international education with a particular focus on children's rights, making it a place where kids are respected. Thank you, Beth. Appreciate your taking time to be on The Point Is.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We got no choice.